You're the meanest old woman that I ever seen. I guess if you say so, I'll have to pack my things and go.
That's right, hit the road, Jack. And don't you come back no more, no more, no more, no more. Hit the road, Jack. And don't you come back no more.
Jack, no slack, go back where you came from.
Ladies and gentlemen, please take your seats. The program is about to begin. Ladies and gentlemen, please silence your cell phones and any other electronic devices. The program is about to begin.
This is Yale Explores, a community of lifelong learners coming together to examine and address the issues shaping our world and the biggest challenges of our time, so we can deepen our understanding today, teach and inspire the leaders of tomorrow, and innovate, collaborate, and accelerate positive change year after year after year. Drawing on the rich resources and heritage of Yale University and fueled by its faculty, students, and alumni, the thinkers, the doers, the creators, the discoverers, the boundary breakers, the difference makers, those committed to leading and serving, those who never stop exploring. This is as Yale explores. Welcome.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the president of the Yale Club of Chicago, Cynthia Okechukwu.
Good evening. It's my pleasure to welcome you all to Yale Explores tonight. It's wonderful to see so many alumni and friendly faces in the audience. As you can see, the Yale Chicago community is thriving. I have the privilege of serving as the president of the Yale Club of Chicago, and on behalf of the rest of our board, I'm delighted to welcome you to the Yale Explores event tonight. We are pleased to co-sponsor tonight's program along with the Yale Alumni Association and a number of other shared interest groups. If you haven't already, please make sure to stop by the Get Involved table that you saw earlier this evening to meet representatives from the various clubs and shared interest groups and to learn more about their activities in the Chicago area, from First Gen Yale to Yale Women to the various graduate and professional student alumni groups. They all contribute to making the Yale Chicago community a thriving community. I hope you've had a chance to visit the Alumni Association's new website and explore everything YAA has to offer. They've been our wonderful hosts for tonight. We are all part of the Yale Alumni Association, and we welcome your input and contributions towards making us a stronger organization in the months and years to come. I also hope that you enjoy the reception, enjoy the opportunity to connect with old friends, as well as hopefully to make some new ones. Please stay after the program for more food and drinks and for the opportunity to interact with our wonderful presenters tonight. And most importantly, don't forget to take a photo in the Yale Explorers photo booth. I'm really thrilled to welcome our presenters to the stage. Tonight's presenters exemplify the groundbreaking cross-disciplinary collaborations that are a hallmark of Yale. Jeffrey Brock is the newly appointed Dean of the Yale School of Engineering and Applied Science, Dean of Science for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences, and Professor of Mathematics. Dean Brock's research focuses on how low-dimensional geometry and topology, particularly hyperbolic geometry. Dean Brock was a Guggenheim Fellow in 2008 and was recently elected Fellow of the American Mathematical Society. Sarah Demers is the Horace D. Taft Associate Professor of Physics. A particle physicist, Professor Demers is interested in the fundamental particles of nature and the forces through which they interact. In addition to teaching the physics of music, Professor Demers teaches the physics of dance with dancer, choreographer, and Yale professor Emily Coates, and with whom she co-authored the recently published book, Physics and Dance. Nick Turk Brown is a professor of psychology at Yale. His lab uses behavioral studies, functional MRI, intracranial recordings, and machine learning to understand the human mind and brain. Professor Turk Brown has published extensively on how we perceive and attend to the world, and how we learn from experience and store information and memory. Most recently, his lab has been studying how the brains of infants and toddlers work. Tonight's moderator, Margaret Warner, served as the 2018 to 2019 Senior Fellow at Yale's Jackson Institute for Global Affairs. She recently stepped down from her post as Chief Global Affairs Correspondent for PBS NewsHour. She joined NewsHour in 1993 after working as a political, White House, and diplomatic correspondent for NewsHour, for Newsweek magazine and the Wall Street Journal, excuse me. Ms. Warner is a graduate of the Yale College class of 1971, our first co-ed class at Yale. Yes. And a former trustee of the university. We are also very fortunate to have President Peter Salovey here with us tonight. He will close the discussion with insights on tonight's topic from the perspective of a social psychologist, highlighting Yale's unique ability to address these challenging issues. Please join me in welcoming Ms. Warner, Dean Brock, and Professors Demers and Turk Brown to the stage for Yale Explores, the Creative Revolution, Inspiring Innovation.
Well, thank you, Cynthia. What a lovely introduction. There'll be a quiz afterwards, but anyway, it's wonderful to be here. It's really a thrill to be in Chicago and with all you Yaleys, parents, friends, of course, and to talk about this kind of mind-bending topic. You know, this elegant auditorium reminds me that I'd always dreamed of performing in Chicago. But that dream died when I couldn't even get into an a cappella group at Yale. So tonight I'm on this stage to bring you alums, what you've asked for, the opportunity to immerse yourself in the intellectual energy of Yale without having to travel to New Haven. Each Yale Explorers event, and this is the seventh so far, delves into a single pressing 21st century issue from a multiplicity of perspectives, drawing on Yale faculty members for that, and we have three of them here who are working in different disciplines. Tonight's topic, of course, is the creativity revolution. Now, what is that, you might ask? That's what I asked. I mean, creativity in the arts, I get, but creativity in the practical world? Well, in fact, there is a quiet revolution underway in business, in the sciences, in engineering, in information, that recognizes the importance of creative thinking, that creative thinking plays in fostering innovation. The business community certainly sees it. I was surprised to read that a number of recent surveys, really over the last almost decade, CEOs say that the top skill they seek when hiring is creativity. I still find it an elusive concept, creativity. The dictionary defines it as the ability to come up with new ideas or to make new things. Practical creativity is using that quality of mind to discover new solutions that will solve problems. Creative thinkers see the world in new ways, or they challenge the traditional thinking in their field, or they identify often unrecognized patterns to devise the solutions. It used to be regarded just as a gift that you were born with, but creativity is now being recognized, believe it or not, as a skill that can be taught. To explore the nature and implications of all this, we have a dazzling trio of Yale faculty, as you've heard, who are doing cutting-edge work in their field. Professor of Psychology, Nick Turk-Brown, Professor of Physics, Sarah Demers, and a Professor of Mathematics, who's also the Engineering School Dean, Jeff Brock. We're going to start just with a brief story showing how creative thinking by a scientist and a mathematician some 75 years ago combined and came together to figure out essentially how the brain works. Now, as is only fitting, the story starts with a Yalee. Meet Warren McCullough, Yale class of 1921. He was a neurophysiologist whose work incorporated ideas from fields as diverse as biology, physics, psychology, and engineering. He was actually working at the University of Chicago in the late 30s, and he was wrestling with the question of how the brain works. He dismissed the then fashionable thinking and theories of Sigmund Freud. He had an inkling that the workings of the mind were rooted in the firing of neurons, but he was completely stuck on how to model it. Now enter Walter Pitts, a homeless runaway teen of 15 with a brilliant mathematical mind who was hanging around the University of Chicago when he was introduced to McCullough by a colleague who thought they would hit it off, and hit it off they did. McCullough shared a paper with Pitts, written by, that he just read, by Alan Turing, the British mathematician, computer science pioneer, mathematician, cryptanalyst, who would go on to create, or help to create, the machine that helped crack the Enigma code, the German Enigma code in World War II. Turing's paper, which preceded this, was about how to create a machine that could compute any function, a computable function. In a really creative leap, McCullough and Pitts seized on the idea that the human brain was just such a machine too. In a now seminal paper published in 1943, the two men revealed their mechanistic model of the mind and argued that the brain is fundamentally an information processor. Their revolutionary idea of neural networks led to modern neuroscience and artificial intelligence, or AI. So for 45 minutes or so, I'm going to explore the reality and implications of today's creativity revolution with our faculty members here, followed by remarks by Yale President Peter Salovey. And since we expect our conversation here will leave some of you with questions of your own, at the reception after this, you'll find designated conversation zones, I'll call them, around each panelist, where you can stop by, have a drink, and continue the discussion. So I'm going to start with Ms. Sarah Demers, Professor Sarah Demers. Sarah, how does creativity, as we've just defined it, contribute to or play into what we think of as a very hard science, physics?
Right. So one of the key ingredients for creativity, as you defined it, is having a problem. So physics is actually fantastic in that we have lots and lots of problems. In particle physics right now, we're trying to understand the fundamental particles, the content of the universe, and how they interact. And we have about 4% of the matter-energy content of the universe cataloged, understood at some level. So we have a long ways to go. And when we try to solve these problems, make progress on that, we have to often invent new technologies. So we have that critical ingredient of a fundamental problem. And then I think if you look back at where there have been big jumps in terms of progress in physics, you often see an element of desperation. It's people who understand the problem deeply and get pushed into a corner and have to question an assumption that no one thought to question before. Just one example, when someone was staring at an experiment and there was a particle that was created and another particle came just flying off in some direction, broke physics. Because if you have zero momentum and then introduce momentum, you have to balance it with something. So you either say, we get rid of conservation of momentum, or there's an invisible particle there. It's a huge leap to say there's actually something there. So a lot of problems and a lot of desperation.
Very interesting. I'm going to turn to Jeff now. What about in your field of mathematics? I mean, which I think of as the ultimate, you know, quantitative exercise. Is creativity, does it play a role there?
Absolutely. And yet, I think my concern about whether that was true led to, I mean, I think of my entry into the field of mathematics as something I was sort of dragged kicking and screaming. So I never imagined, even though I liked math, that I would want to sit in a, you know, you have this vision of the solitary genius in mathematics,
yes,
sitting in a cinder block office toiling over or writing on the blackboard. And it was actually the experience of doing undergraduate research that exposed the idea that a lot of mathematics, first of all, was very socially engaged and collaborative, but that a lot of what you do, you said quantitative, so what the field of mathematics I'm involved in is called topology, and that's the study, the mathematical study of shapes. And the research project I was involved in involved something called knot theory. So that's
not?
K-N-O-T, knot theory. And so we spent the summer drawing pictures of knots and trying to understand how to tell when one knot that you draw is different from another. And then it turns out this leads to questions about how to develop algebraic structures that tell these different knots apart. But indeed, I think the creative spark is a lot of what draws mathematicians to their craft. I mean, the idea that this flash of insight or this hard-won sort of push beyond the boundary of what you thought you knew.
And briefly, for the two of you, Sarah and Jeff, did you borrow from other fields? Can you just say briefly how?
So in physics, there are a couple of beautiful examples. You're talking about me personally or just in general?
Just in history, even.
In
just
history.
One even.
Yeah, okay, one. our current theories of everything potential theories of everything, string theory, actually is based on mathematics of vibrating strings that mathematicians were working out. It's the idea of vibrating strings having different resonant modes, and the particles that we see in the universe all around us are different resonances of those nodes, like musical notes are to vibrating strings.
So Nick, I'm going to turn to you as the man who studies the brain, and tell us, is there something different about a creative mind? What has neuroscience discovered, if anything, about where creativity originates in the mind? Is it from a certain region of the brain, or is it something observable, testable in a lab?
It's a fundamental question about human behavior, how it is that we take what we see and what we've experienced and create something new from that. That's the problem of creativity. In terms of whether the creative brain is different than the less creative brain, yes, in some sense, by definition, anything that manifests in people behaving differently is caused by some change in the brain. It depends how you define creativity, I suppose. So to me, creativity means coming up with novel solutions to problems than what other people would come up with.
Right.
Fundamentally thinking differently from other people. And if you define creativity that way, there are many ways in which people think differently. One is in cases of mental health disorders. So for example, in schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, there's evidence that your genetic risk factor for those disorders is associated with more creative thinking. Defined in different ways. So that's an example of a different brain that is more creative in that sense. But in general, I think if you look at people who are more creative in laboratory measures, so if you test people on their creativity, their ability to come up with a novel use for an object or a novel thought, that relates to certain changes in the brain. So your brain is composed of several different networks of regions that work together. And those networks generally work in opposition. So just to give you an example, there's one network in your brain that sort of comes online when you're thinking inside your head. Your eyes might be open, but you're really chewing on something that you heard or remembering something from the past or worrying about some anxiety. So that network is kind of internally focused, where there's another network that's really externally focused if you're on a roller coaster or if you're in a lecture, hopefully you're all paying attention to us up here. Those networks are usually in opposition. People, when they're chewing on their thoughts, are not paying attention to the outside world. Turns out that creative people, or people who are more creative, those networks, or at least the regions that make up those networks, talk to each other more. It's as if there's more of a handshake between internal generation and external input and evaluation. So those are some ways you can study it. You could use brain imaging methods. You could study people with brain damage, but yeah.
So I'll ask you all, just jump in here. Does a creative idea just burst in like a bolt from the blue, like eureka, I realize this or that? Or is it a product of something, is it some other process?
I think it's often misunderstood because when we think of the creative brain or the creative solution, you're just focused on the eureka. But underneath it, you have to have done the preparation. You have to understand the problem you're trying to solve, and you have to have some openness or exposure to coming at it from a different direction. So I don't know. I mean, there is that eureka that's a critical piece of it, but I think focusing on that outcome might make us depressed thinking about how possible it is to make it happen more often, right? There's a process underneath it, or there's at least preparation of some kind.
Chime in, gentlemen.
Yeah, so for me, it's usually in the shower. After I've spent, you know, the whole day, the day before, it's sort of banging my head against the wall about a problem, and then, Nick can probably comment on this, but there's something that happens while you're asleep, and certain kinds of connections are made, and then you get up, and you sort of get your coffee, and get in the shower, and then all of a sudden, usually it's when my wife says, Jeff, what have you been doing in there for the last 15 minutes? And it's working out a math problem, and I'm stuck, and I think I've almost got it. So there is something, a bit more seriously, to the act of practice and rehearsal of a set of kind of structured ideas that
and I think of this as akin to music, which I, you know, also spent a lot of time doing, where you kind of get to where you have a certain facility and things become a little more second nature, and then you're able to kind of jump off from that to some other level where an insight can happen.
So there's relatively little shower neuroscience today, although maybe we can work on that. But what Jeff's getting at, I think, is really fundamental. So I think there's a distinction between ideas that we have spontaneously and ideas that we work out deliberatively. But even the spontaneous ideas, as Sarah was saying, are built on a foundation of knowledge. And knowledge helps us see the whole space of possibilities. It's especially when you have knowledge of different fields that you can draw novel mm-hmm. connections. Knowledge can also be a curse, especially if it's restricted to one domain. It can stick you in one way of thinking about a problem, and so how to break out of that is a challenge. But the kind of shower thoughts that Jeff is having, the idea is your mind's working all the time, even while you're sleeping. And a big part of sleep is about replaying what happened during the day, forming novel connections in your brain, storing memories, and that's thought to be part of the process of being able to draw new inferences, come up with new ideas.
Knowing that that happens changes how I watch movies. I've heard of this idea, and I know I close my eyes more, you know? I don't want my brain replaying everything. That's important to keep in mind as you move through the world. My mother used to say, guard your mind, and she had no idea the neuroscience that was at work behind that.
So this will be a tough one to answer, because you all aren't in the sort of creative, the worlds of application. But, you know, someone in the audience who's, say, in business, might say, kind of, so what? Why do we need creativity? Why do we need to understand this knot? Or what would you say to that?
Well, I think it's, as you said in your introduction, that there's actually almost a culture of creativity in so much of the business world and so much of the, you know, the jobs that we're training our students to do. You just hear it in the language, thinking outside the box, or, you know, we have a culture of entrepreneurship. And I think that maybe this is a somewhat American phenomenon, but we've always, I think, valorized this in our culture, this sort of ability to innovate and to come up with new ideas. It sort of runs through our culture, but I think we've gotten to a place now where in just the basic educational structures, we're thinking a lot more about this. I mean, when I was coming up learning mathematics, a lot of it still was kind of drill and skill. And now the way we try to engage even our very young students is to just allow them to play around with concepts and to almost to have them think conceptually about what the solution could be to a problem rather than just training them on the basics. And there's some mixture. I mean, I think we don't teach the violin that way. We mm-hmm. make them play scales and things like, you know. But I think as our culture has matured around this idea, it's actually one of the things that we really hold dear is this idea that we're going to think of our education this way.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons that I can imagine creativity being important in business is similar to in science, actually. Mm-hmm. Nick pointed out that there can be a danger to knowledge. And mm-hmm. that's a real problem if you're working in a scientific field and you can't let go of assumptions because you don't recognize that you're making the assumptions, mm-hmm. right? If you've been working in a framework. Things are changing so rapidly now with technology. I can imagine that not being creative, not being open, and seeing different ways of tackling problems is a real risk in business, mm-hmm. in the same way that it stops us in science.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the added value of humans in any enterprise is to go beyond what's put in front of us, you know.
I'm glad there's still a role.
there are very few machines that are able to extrapolate far beyond what they were trained to do, and humans are able to do that. We have a lot of training throughout our childhood and our life that make us able to see connections between different aspects of life that wouldn't otherwise be connected. And I think the reason that businesses and organizations value human individuals so highly is because their ability to take the same information and produce different outputs than what somebody else would do or what a machine would do.
So how do you each try to foster creativity in your students? Now, obviously, they're not young. They're college age and beyond. But can you give me an example?
I think what I have tried to do, although it is difficult, sometimes, you know, you just have to get through a certain kind of material in your class, but for certain projects, it's good. I mean, even giving college students things like manipulatives, like there are these little, I own some of these, I'll admit, there are these little tiles you can buy that you can sort of stick together, and if you get, there's some that look like equilateral triangles, and you can teach students about curvature in mathematics by just having them take these equilateral triangles and stick them together. If you take five triangles around a vertex, then if you keep doing this, you develop a dodecahedron. If you do mm-hmm. four, you get a tetrahedron. If you do six, you get a flat plane. And what's interesting is that if you try to do this with seven, you get something that's very complicated, and it turns out that's a representation of hyperbolic geometry, the thing that
really?
Was mentioned in the beginning. It's a negatively curved surface. So if you're trying to teach students about negative curvature, they may think, well, why am I playing with these triangles? I'm a graduate student in mathematics. But as long as you've given them the tools to understand what the mathematics is, it's a really useful manipulative. So I think actually having these visualization tools and, frankly, teaching them about how to program computers to render some of these visualizations is also really important. I think it's a really good test of core knowledge if they can do that, too.
It's a great example. Sarah or Nick?
Yeah, I think the most important thing that I try to do with my students is make sure that we have a strong foundation. So that's critical, so that if we're going to be trying to, you know, I think that's really important. You have to understand a problem enough so that you recognize a solution that's coming from the outside. Another component that I think is important, and I guess this comes back to the shower, is just time when you're not focused on something, obviously. So one of the challenges that our students have more than I did, when I was in college, I didn't have a cell phone. I had a lot more staring out the window time. I didn't have an email address. So I think trying to encourage walks and just time when your brain is resting is another piece that's important. The thing I struggle with my students, and I'm still trying to understand, is this idea of interdisciplinarity. I have a couple of students who are, they're artists and scientists, mm-hmm. and one of the questions that I think we're grappling with from the education perspective is, what's the right way to train that? Do you have the deep scientist who then talks to the deep, you know, the physicist and the biologist? Where do you pair them? When do you start that? What's the right way so that you can make links across disciplines? That's something that I'm still struggling with, and I think we're still trying to figure out.
So how do you do it with your students? I mean,
with my students, they are getting their PhDs in physics, and so that's mm-hmm. where they're driving deep. And then they are doing, I have a student who is doing AI-based choreography. So she does that. I give her time for that, and we support it. And we talk about it. What do you want your platform to be? Where are you headed? What are you thinking of doing with this? And we have conversations. But, you know, it's probably different for every person, how they mm-hmm. see themselves fitting in, what questions they find most interesting.
So, Nick, I want to, and I don't know if Cynthia explained this, but you run a whole lab that looks at everything from perception to hearing and memory. Mm-hmm. So in a lab, is there room for creativity?
Yeah, absolutely. In a few ways.
Teaching your students.
Yeah. So in terms of teaching, I mean, at an undergraduate level, I'm teaching Introduction to Psychology right now, and so I have the opportunity to really put into practice a lot of ideas about how to promote retention and learning and creativity. But in terms of running a lab, I would say there's creativity in a few places, and this is probably common across us. One is in terms of picking a problem to work on. It's very easy to read the latest article of or issue of a journal and find an article that somebody else published and to think of what's the next incremental step in that research program. It's much harder to find a fundamental problem where you can make a big impact in a new area. That's something that I think we bring as advisors to help steer people towards big problems. So that's one aspect of creativity, finding something new and different, breaking out of what seems obvious. The other is on the flip side, once you have a problem and you've collected data, trying to understand those data and really using different computational methods, using statistical methods, but also being open to the possibility that your hypothesis is wrong and that you might have to rethink how things work. It's not a good theory if it's not testable, and we're often wrong. And if you're right, that confirms what you thought before, but if you're not right, then you have to go back and reconsider. And I think there's a lot of creativity in making sense of data. We spend a lot of time in my lab thinking through what would this mean with respect to everything we know. How does this fit with other problems?
Can you give me an example that most of us would understand?
Yeah. So, well, that's giving me too much credit, I think. So, for example, one of the things we're working, Cynthia mentioned this before, we're studying the brains of infants and toddlers. And part of the reason I'm working on this problem is that when you're an adult, you don't remember very much from when you were younger than, say, 3 or 4 years old. If I polled everybody in the room, I doubt many of you would remember much from before 3 or 4. It's called infantile amnesia. And you might think that that means that infants and toddlers don't have memory, but anybody who has had kids knows that that's not true. They remember what you promised them. They remember who hit them at daycare. They remember where they hid some toy. They actually have very detailed memories. So there's this weird juxtaposition. How can we make sense of, as an adult, not remembering much from early in life, but as a kid, learning so much, learning a language, learning how to walk, learning about social relationships? And so based on the fact that we don't remember much from early in life, people assumed that the memory structures in the brain didn't work. And when we started actually doing neuroscience, where we're doing brain imaging studies of infants and toddlers, we discovered that those brain systems actually work quite well. They just learn in a different way than the way they work in adults. And so the answer wasn't that young kids don't have memories, it's just they store information differently. What they do is they pick up on general patterns. They don't remember specific events as well as adults do. And so that's an example. We found actually these brain regions that were thought to be inactive were actually very engaged early on in life. And so trying to figure out what are they doing if they're not producing memories that'll stick around when you're an adult.
So what are they doing? What happened to all that, those early memories that aren't conventional memories?
Yeah, so what they're doing is something that we call statistical learning, which is a technical term. It just means picking up on patterns. The most obvious example of this is language acquisition. Mm-hmm. So when you're a baby, you're just sitting there. You're not trying to learn language. People around you are talking, and sometimes they're talking at you, sometimes they're not. How do you find the words in your language? It's an old problem in philosophy. We do it, and they're not baked into us. So you're not born knowing what language you're going to need to learn. You learn it through experience, and it turns out you do it by picking up on patterns. Bay is followed by B. You hear baby a lot, right? And so that's a very reliable pattern that helps you figure out the baby is a word. Other transitions between B and whatever word comes next are going to be less probable. And so by combining a lot of different memories, we can figure out what are the reliable patterns in the language input we get and figure out what the words are in our language. So that's one example, but that's the kind of learning that babies are really good at, picking up on patterns in their environment. And that kind of learning isn't so good for remembering that one time that you heard the word baby. Mm-hmm. But it's really good at finding out what tends to be true in my environment.
Now, someone brought up creativity in the practical world, but connected to the arts. And Sarah, you are collaborating with a dancer, I understand. You've written a book, you do concerts, you talk about this collaboration. Tell us a little about that. Well, what are you trying to do?
Right. It started, we were put together to teach a class. And I should say, I was talking about how you train students for interdisciplinarity. I think from the undergraduate perspective, the liberal arts is a fantastic foundation for that. Exposure broadly is really critical. So we were teaching, we got together to teach the class, and we were sitting in my office talking through the syllabus, and Emily Coates, who's my collaborator, said, well, basically what choreographers do is we study energy, space, and time. And I said, no, you don't. That's what I do. We get that. Physics has that. What are you talking about? And she walked through how it is that choreographers work with these concepts. We just have had so much fun together. I think we also are big advocates for our disciplines, so we're on crusades together. But that really has kept it going, and I've learned so much just by confronting a different process and taking another discipline as an equal partner. Mm-hmm. We each give in that against stereotypes. We wrote a manifesto together to make sure that we do this. I'd always wanted a manifesto since reading Kandinsky's manifesto. But the first line of the manifesto is that physics and dance share equal creative, intellectual, rigorous research power. And we start from that assumption, and it's taken us a lot of really interesting places.
And Jeff, what about you? You were a professional bass player.
For a time. I still get out occasionally.
It started at Yale or before that?
That's right, yeah. So in fact, one of the first people I met at Yale in the common room at Sabre College was Vijay Iyer, who is now an acclaimed jazz musician. And he and I struck up a relationship very quickly. He was a physics major, also a phenomenal jazz pianist, and I was a bass player. And so we would play duo in the dining hall every night and had a great time with that. First, people were kind of wondering what was going on, but, you know, after a while, they started clapping and enjoying the performances. But then it turns out we both went to graduate school at Berkeley, him in physics and I in mathematics. And so then we actually started playing a lot in the Bay Area jazz scene, and we recorded a couple of CDs together with a trio. And what was, to the point of creativity, what was interesting to me about that is one of the things he was really focused on in terms of his compositions was how to take complicated mathematical ideas and try to make them musical. And so, for example, we would have kind of a rhythmic pattern that was 5 beats long and a melodic pattern that was 9 beats long, and these things would sort of come together every 45th beat. Now, that sounds hopelessly nerdy, except that if you actually try to make that musical, you can spend hours and hours and hours practicing it, and all of a sudden there's something that happens over a certain period of time. And I think of this as like mathematics. You get so deeply immersed in a space that all of a sudden new things start to percolate up and pop out at you, and you can do new things with the music. And for those first two CDs, that was kind of what we were focusing on. So, you know, my advisor probably wouldn't have been terribly happy with me to know how much time I was spending on this while I was in graduate school. But I think, like the kinds of project you're describing, it sparks different kinds of pathways in the brain. Again, I don't have a good sort of vocabulary for thinking about that, Nick, but I think it was really important for the creative process of being a PhD student in the end.
So, Nick, what does it create in the brain? This is your expertise. Does it open up new pathways, artistic?
Are you asking about Jeff's brain or the brain in general?
Well, I don't know. Jeff's brain may be tough. Need more lab work.
Jeff's brain is extraordinary. But creativity is a scientific discipline. That's sort of what I suppose what's interesting about psychology and neuroscience is that we practice creativity in our research, no matter what topic you study. But it's also a subject of investigation, and so there's research on creativity, and there's some research on training creativity, as you mentioned before. There's some malleability or flexibility. There are ways of learning to be more creative. And so there are some studies where you'll scan somebody's brain and then bring them back for a series of training sessions. And those training sessions are fairly basic things. Show you an object and have you think about, say, a watering can, and have you think for 3 minutes about new ways of using a watering can, for example. That's one kind of task. And you might do that 20 times. Or 20 different sessions, so a lot of training. And then bring them back later on for another brain scan, and you could say, well, what's different in the brain now that you've spent all that time practicing of thinking of new uses for objects? And it turns out that there's certain parts of the brain that are more active now, including in frontal and parietal lobes in your brain. What more activity means is a little unclear from those studies. There's also studies showing that the volume of gray matter, the amount of gray matter you have in certain brain regions, increases from this kind of creativity training. So it is possible that Jeff's advisor should have applauded his improvisation, right? That it may have increased his ability to draw new connections, to do analogical reasoning, to hold more information in memory, for example. But yeah, that's a new emerging area of research in psychology and neuroscience. So just a little tidbits of evidence, but I think it's a growing field.
That's fascinating.
Wild. I mean, you know, you think about what you do with your children playing, right? And they take the bowl and they put it on their heads, and you try to applaud that, but you do find yourself telling them, no, that's a bowl.
Right.
And then we have to go back as adults and try to go back and play, and let me try to, that's right, I'm putting,
But the idea that it's observable with the brain activity, I'm surprised that wasn't a headline in, I don't know, Time magazine, especially when people think about creating more gray matter. Or white matter.
Gray.
White matter's bad. Gray. Gray matter's good. So you mentioned earlier, Jeff, the scientist working alone in a cement, whatever. Or, you know, I think an opera composer now just going in the pure arts, you know, toiling away in an attic. I don't know. That's not a good analogy, but anyway. Is creativity mostly a solo exercise, you and your mind going over what you've learned, and or is it more social, more
so
communal?
I'm really glad you asked that question, because I think it gives, I think, each of us probably the opportunity as scientists, and that was one of the things I was really excited about this panel, was that there were three scientists who, you know, suffer from, in some sense, the false perception that what they're doing isn't particularly creative. And one of the things that I think is so deeply creative about it, and that I draw a lot of analogies, I guess, between playing like in a jazz quartet or working with three collaborators on a project, is that each individual is bringing a certain kind of perceptual map to a problem. And you find these points of intersection, and you find that you've thought through something in one way and someone else has thought through it in another. And it's kind of like, you know, realizing that you've thought about a musical passage in the same way as the trio you're working with. Or actually, we were talking about rowing earlier. It's sort of like, you know, the way that you can sync up with a group of people that, I don't know, it's something kind of transcendent about the human condition. And I think that it's that reaching for the boundary of what everyone knows and trying to combine that into something that actually solves a problem or creates new insight. And it's not always, I think when we talk about problem solving, it seems somehow instrumental. And in fact, what it is that you're sort of, I think of it as exploring. I mean, you're sort of mapping out a landscape in your mind of the way a musical piece works or the way a mathematical problem behaves, and it just leads to more, and you have new avenues that you can pursue as a result of this collaboration. So, I mean, again, when I decided actually to go into mathematics, it was partly because I felt like this was something we could do collaboratively, and that's really one of the great things about it, and you know, we were talking also earlier about travel, and it's somehow exhausting, but one of the things that's great about being an academic is you get to travel to places where you get together with people that are some of the, you know, handful of people that speak the language of knots, you know, and there just aren't that many people out there that know about knots, and so you're really excited to go talk to people about knots, and you may be this, you know, this weird group in the pub that's sitting around talking about knots, everyone wondering when you're going to leave, but but it's a great thing, and I think that's that shared experience of exploring and mapping a new space that's so exciting about it to me.
Nick, you were nodding through much of that. Yeah. Pick up on that.
Well, I mean, even the example you started with was Turing's, you know, theory influencing how essentially a biologist was thinking. There's a certain zeitgeist, there's a culture of science. I think that we are often thought of as solitary, you know, people toiling away. But in reality, if it wasn't us making some of these discoveries in this moment with this, you know, set of ideas and this group of people working in our field, somebody else would come up with a related idea. And so we serve a function of realizing the momentum of our field. And I think we hopefully add something to it. We permute it in some way, we contribute, but I think it's really a collective cultural effort. And I should say, just personally, my greatest joy as a scientist is in training, you know, graduate students, postdocs, and undergraduates. I think we all derive greatest joy from inspiring others, or at least getting other people excited about what we work on and seeing them flourish into budding scientists. And so it's that process of rearing the next generation mm-hmm. of scientists that I think is one of the most rewarding aspects of what we do, which is an inherently social activity.
And creative.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They're all different.
You want to weigh in, Sarah, on this idea of you're already collaborating with your choreographer, but
right.
in physics in general.
Right. So Jeff has four not collaborators, maybe locally. I work on a collaboration, the Atlas experiment at the Large Hadron Collider at CERN with 3,500. So that really takes a village. And you could say we do that by necessity. We can only afford to have one machine like that in the world, so we all have to go there. And the detector itself is six stories high and the length of a football field, so you need a lot of people to build it and operate it. And we have a lot of data to analyze it. But it is an extremely social interaction. And I think it's impossible, if I look at ideas that I've had, it's impossible for me to untangle where the suggestions came from, who fed into them when. And to be honest, a lot of it happens in meetings. We have a lot of research meetings.
Oh, no, dreaded meetings.
No, I know, but when they're actually about physics, there's
probably a lot more interesting than, some others. So we've been talking about all these possibilities and wonderful frontier-breaking things you're all doing, but what hampers creativity? Mm. Sarah, what's your experience? I mean, whether you're teaching students or just in your own thinking.
Right. I think it's being too busy, being too tired, and I think also fundamentally not being brave enough. I think it is hard sometimes to give yourself permission to say, I'm going to tackle that problem that we've had that has been sticking people for a long time. So you have to have some courage if you're going to come up with something that is a little bit different.
And do you all find how much resistance is there among maybe some of your older colleagues or just other colleagues who have done something the same way for a long time?
Well, that's a tough question. I think there are different styles of scientists, and there are some who make very profound contributions in one field of research, mm-hmm. and they become world's expert in that subfield, and they work on it for their entire careers, and I think that's incredibly valuable. They work out a problem to the nth degree. I think there are other scientists who really initiate new fields. They may not work out all the details, mm-hmm. but they demonstrate that it's possible to address some problem. And so I think that there are these different scientific personalities, and I think it's not a generational thing so much. I know colleagues in general at all institutions who fall into those two mm-hmm. camps and various places between them. I'm kind of on a 5 to 10 year cycle. I like to work on a problem for a while, mm-hmm. work it out a little bit, and then tackle something new and exciting. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's what I see, I think, is that both have value, but there are people who are, who really, I think, because of their disposition or their interests, are groundbreaking pioneers, and then will do a lot of that, actually, in mm-hmm. several different fields over the course of their career.
And a real benefit of academia is that we have the 18-year-old undergraduate who's working with the person whose age I won't name, emeritus professor. I mean, you know, there's no upper or lower limit in some ways, and it's not a perfect structure, but it tends to be pretty flat, really. People are all trying to, and we're getting better about being inclusive so that people feel that they can have a seat at the table. But there's a lot of, you know, we have the new students who are up on the latest machine learning techniques, and they're writing new kinds of code. And they're, when you pair that kind of a person with someone who has the experience of running a detector for 40 or 50 years, assuming people are communicating, which they kind of have to, it's a powerful combination.
Yeah, undergraduates usually tackle the riskiest, most ambitious projects in my lab because they have the least to lose, right? Yes. They're not getting their PhD. They just want to learn skills and knowledge. I've published some of the most papers I'm proudest about with undergraduates who weren't averse to this. And so I think getting undergraduates involved in research has been really important for my lab. You know, I'm co-director of the neuroscience major, which is a growing, relatively new major on campus, and all of the seniors need to do a full year of empirical research. And I think that's true about many majors on campus. And so I think that that's one way to really push through new boundaries. They're not cursed with knowledge in the same way we are, and they're more reckless. They have nothing to lose and willing to tackle big problems.
I wish there were a way to sort of systematize it. You know, I mean, I think we do try to teach students to be creative, but even, you know, in terms of your own self-governance as a researcher, it's really tricky, and, you know, because frequently it is these flashes of insight, and, you know, there's the path breakers, and there's also the kind of people who draw analogies between examples they see in different fields, and each can be kind of a creative insight that can drive things forward. The only thing I've ever heard that works like this well is there are people who kind of keep a problem list, and some are like long range and some are medium range. And every time they go to a new talk or learn something new, they go through that list and say, oh, I wonder if this will solve this. And I've never been able to do that, so I don't really know how effective it might be. But, you know, I think to the sort of generational issue, we're living in an incredible time in the sense that we now have these tools of insight that fundamentally we really don't understand, in the sense that these examples of neural networks, deep nets, so-called, are generating insights about science and about problems where we don't have a complete explanation for where the insight comes from. So, just as an example, the World Go champion was just bested a few years back by a neural network trained by DeepMind, which is now owned by Google. And the interesting bit to that is that the experts who were watching this game did not experience it as a brute force match. That in fact the algorithm made a move at a certain stage in the game that caught everyone completely by surprise, and it seemed totally out of place. And yet, about 20 moves later, it became clear that it was this sort of incredibly insightful choice of a place to place a piece on the board that ultimately led to the win. And so we have
tools. By the computer.
Yeah, by the computer. So some flash of insight by the computer to see how to solve this problem. That now I think we as researchers, if you sort of translate that over to the scientific laboratory, are trying to understand what these algorithms are producing and why they're doing what they're doing. And I think that is going to be a defining element of science in the new generation, is how we can kind of bridge the gap between algorithmic tools that we're seeing being developed using data science, using AI, and our own understanding of the fundamental physics or mathematics of the problem involved. And it does come up in math, actually.
Nick, you're nodding. You want to?
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting juxtaposition because there are systems now that are far better than humans at solving specific tasks. I mean, this was always true. A calculator could do more calculation than you could do, but it's to a greater degree now there are systems that recognize faces better than humans, for example. Right. And there are systems that solve complex games or problems better than humans and can do so in creative ways that might reveal something What is not happening right now in industry is the ability to train general purpose systems, so a system that can play Go but can also fold laundry or cook dinner, right? And I think there's a, you know, inspired by Jeff's comment, I think there's real progress to be made into thinking what makes that possible for humans.
Yes.
To do that, to learn how to play a game, to learn how to fold laundry, to learn how to make dinner.
And have dinner on the table.
Right.
All at once. Right.
What makes that possible for us? And maybe there's some deep understanding there about how we structure problems, how we solve problems, how we think creatively, that allows us to have multiple functions and to be effective at multiple things. And so, again, it's drawing inspiration from industry, in that case of failures, but also successes, as Jeff pointed out.
Sarah, you want to add to this? We're just about out of time. But
I think it's true in my field that machine learning, neural nets, it's really revolutionizing what we can do and how we can work with the data. Really because of the nature of quantum mechanics, the experiments in my field are all statistical, meaning you never know in any given interaction what actually happened. And in some cases, that's not even a fair question to be posing, depending on what stage you're looking at an interaction. So the computers are the algorithms are incredibly powerful in picking out things from the data, to the point where it got a bit depressing, because we would come as physicists and say, ah, I've made a Higgs boson. The Higgs boson has a mass. Let me train this, you know, let me look for masses. But the computer that you just throw everything at somehow picks out those events better than you did putting your knowledge in. But what we're learning is that as powerful as these algorithms are, they also really need a lot of guidance. They don't replace us in any way. The interpretation of what they're doing and the guiding of what they're doing is critical. So it is an exciting time. We're still figuring out how to use these new tools and finding different ways to add value as physicists.
Yeah, I think there's this idea of having the scientist in the loop that's really critical, and you know, understanding what the model is, whether it's a mathematical model, a physical model, or whatever, a biological model, that is generating the data that you're seeing. And somehow that's where we can actually build science through these tools and through our own creative insights.
Well, all I can say is I wish I'd been a student of any of you. I might have even gone into physics, Sarah.
There's still time.
thank you so much. Join me in thanking this fabulous panel. Good job. Really. You're great. Gotta take this on the road. Well, I think you got a sense of some of the incredible intellectual ferment and energy at Yale. My last welcome job will be to introduce to you now Peter Salovey, the president of Yale, the father of the concept of emotional intelligence, and also my friend, Peter Salovey.
So good evening, everyone. Thank you for being here. Thank you for joining us. Wasn't it exciting to actually have Margaret Warner here as our guide for tonight's program? Great. And why don't we take a moment and thank the three professors once again who gave us their time. So these professors, their discussion illustrates, I think, the importance of Yale research, of Yale teaching, for empowering groundbreaking scientific discoveries, for preparing aspiring leaders of promise and integrity who will serve all sectors of society. I want to share with you some of my thoughts from over three decades of work in higher education and in psychology. And of course, I look forward to hearing your thoughts at the reception in just a few minutes. So in my visits with experts, leaders at universities and businesses, in government organizations across the country, I've seen that a major issue emerges in the last two decades. And that's the issue of the state of creativity. For much of American history, we have taken pride in being a beacon of innovation, of creativity. Our economic growth as a country was built on our collective ability to generate new ideas, to put them into action. Great social and medical and technological and business advances all came from our creative energies. But I think we're seeing something profound, some evidence of an erosion, actually, in creative thinking in our country. So an educational psychologist at the College of William and Mary studied the creativity of over 250,000 children and adults. She looked at how they produced original ideas. She looked at how they put diverse information together, how they display curiosity and open-mindedness. And what she found is that creativity in our country has actually been declining in kids of that age over the 21st century. There's a business professor at the University of Toronto who warned about a looming creativity crisis in the United States. He talks a lot about the rise of creativity in the U.S. in the years after World War II. There was a surge in the number of people pursuing higher education. That was due in large part to the GI Bill. And at the same time, the newly formed venture capital industry was bringing ideas coming from universities to the market. But he warned, and this is a quote from him, the global talent pool and the high-end, high-margin creative industries that used to be the sole province of the United States are dispersing around the globe. A number of countries are learning from our past successes. They're investing in higher education, they're nurturing creative people, and they're putting exciting products on the market, from K-pop to rock music, from new models of cell phones to advanced drones. Now, I actually think this is a good thing, because those accomplishments challenge us to do more. Competition reminds us that we can't rest on our laurels. We must invest now more than ever in the vital and signature element that American universities contribute to the economy, contribute to society, contribute to the future, and that is creativity. So unlike any other sector, universities bring together the best minds across cultures, across national borders, political differences, socioeconomic divides, all in the free pursuit of knowledge and understanding so that we can create new ways to improve the world. We can create knowledge and catalyze transformative advances in society because of our dual mission of research and education. We're incubators for ideas that can lead to marvelous inventions, inventions that are good for the economy and our health and our well-being. Not only do faculty members at Yale and other research universities create new knowledge, but we also foster creativity in our students. I think you could hear that in the way that our panelists spoke this evening. You heard about a creativity revolution from some of Yale's most creative, innovative thinkers. On our campus today, faculty members are helping students to learn broadly, and they're challenging them to exercise their minds. We're preparing them to be flexible thinkers that can draw out the strength of Yale's art schools, the depths of our humanities departments, the expertise of our social scientists, the innovation of our engineers and our natural scientists. And we provide students opportunities to learn by doing. They're with the mentorship of faculty members who are leading research programs from astronomy to urban studies. They are working with them. They are working next to Nobel laureates, next to Pulitzer Prize winners. They're working next to leaders who have transformed our understanding of the world and influenced national and international thinking about pressing global challenges. From these experts, students not only gain knowledge, but they also gain the confidence and foundation to add to the sum of human achievement. Undergraduates and graduate students learn to work with their peers as well from different schools across our new innovation corridor. This is the neighborhood between Hill House Avenue and Prospect Street, where we bring together the arts, sciences, technology, and creativity. In these new spaces, students make devices, create new ventures, are more connected with entrepreneurs. But more importantly, they gain experience in applying creative and multidisciplinary approaches to solving problems, to serving society. A couple of months ago, an alumnus sent me a newspaper clipping from the Houston Chronicle. The article was about women entrepreneurs, and who they're at the forefront of Houston's booming tech ecosystem. And it featured Diana Liu. Diana Liu earned her MBA from Yale School of Management in 2018. When Diana arrived at Yale, she wanted to do something about the corrosion problem that challenges the oil and gas industry. She knew that corrosion inspections of oil and gas lines are labor-intensive and they're dangerous. And she knew that they also don't reliably prevent leaks that lead to serious health and environmental hazards. You know, according to the National Association of Corrosion Engineers, every year the cost of corrosion is estimated to approach $2.5 trillion around the world, about 3% of global GDP. Diana wanted to know how to solve this problem, but she didn't know how. So she spent her first weeks on campus networking. And that's when she met Petter Wellen and Brian Durfeld. They were two seniors majoring in mechanical engineering in Yale College. And the three of them made use of mentors from Yale faculty and workspaces in the new innovation corridor. And they came up with a creative solution to the corrosion problem. Robots. Robots that crawl along a gas or oil pipeline and continuously collect data on the state of corrosion at any point along that pipeline. From this idea, Diana founded Airex Technologies while she was still a student at Yale. And then she took this company to Houston after she graduated last year. Their invention could dramatically improve how companies perform maintenance to prevent leaks that can devastate our environment and our health. Because of alumni like Diana and the students who are creating solutions to domestic and global problems on campus today, I can be pretty optimistic about creativity in the United States. But I take seriously the changing landscape of innovation around the world. Yale has to fulfill its responsibility to foster creativity through research and scholarship, and to teach students the skills needed to problem solve, to make novel connections between ideas, and as a result, to produce original works. We work to champion creative thinkers, and we inspire innovation not just for our own economy and well-being, but we really do this for the good of the world, to solve the major challenges facing us today, which of course are global challenges. So I want to thank you for joining me this evening for our Yale Explorers event. I'm eager to hear from you about your experiences and perspectives about this creativity revolution around the U.S. and around the world. What do you think we can do at Yale to enhance our students' creativity? What helps you to be creative in problem solving? I look forward to hearing this as I walk around the reception immediately following this program. But in the meantime, can you join me in one more round of applause as we thank Margaret and our faculty for a very interesting discussion tonight? Great. So now, why don't you join me outside and we'll have a little more refreshment and get a chance to talk to each other. Thank you all for being here tonight. Thanks so much.
ladies and gentlemen. Be sure to post your thoughts on this evening to hashtag YaleExplores. Thank you again.